Welcome to the Aging Project podcast. We called it that for a reason, because yes, aging is happening to all of us. But how we age? Well, that's not just luck. It's shaped by the choices we make. That's why we say you are the project. Your health, your body, your habits, your next chapter. This podcast, our 120 Club, and our products exist to keep you focused on what really matters. For those who are ready to take action, grab our free scorecard, including the 10 markers we want you to start tracking now. You can download them at theagingproject.com. We believe there is no reason women can't live to 100 or even 120. So let's get on with doing it together. Before we begin, a quick reminder, if any products are mentioned in today's conversation, you'll find them at youmusttryit.com. And with that, let's dive into today's conversation. Friends, our mission here is really simple. It's just to help you live healthier for longer. And today we're going to talk about something that has been tiptoed around. It's been sugar-coated and it's been packaged into magazine headlines and diet trends for far too long. It is your waistline. Because here's the truth. Most of us don't need gentle reminders. We don't need another vague or polite conversation. Sometimes we need the clear, honest truth, the kind that cuts through the noise and actually changes our behavior. And the truth is, growing waistlines have quietly become one of the biggest preventable health issues of our generation. Not because anyone is failing and not because women aren't trying, but because the modern world makes it easy to drift and midlife biology can amplify that drift. What makes it even harder is that it's been normalized. So many women assume it's just what happens with age, and no one explains that your waistline is a vital sign that you need to start tracking. That's why today's conversation matters so much. Our guest works on the front line, treating the preventable conditions tied to weight and metabolic health. And she's one of the leading voices with a lifetime of experience. Because if we're going to age well, we must address, excuse the pun, the elephant in the room. We have to be brave enough to talk about it and smart enough to tackle the problem together. So to help us get to the heart of this conversation, please welcome Professor Catherine Samaras. Catherine, I don't know how you talk about this every day because it's such a tough conversation to have, even with your girlfriends or your sisters.
Yeah, look, I mean, it is, as you say, the elephant in the room, and it is a kind of gentle prompt to take action so we can actually enjoy an extended, we're granted long life. What we want is health span. And that actually means that we are healthy right until the end. So if we're going to live to 86, which is the current, you know, estimated life expectancy for a woman in Australia, let that be 86 years of making trouble for people and climbing mountains and doing exactly what we want rather than, you know, stuck in a hospital on life support or requiring dementia care or battling chemotherapy. So I think it really does matter.
It's a frightening future when you say it like that, isn't it? And we really know that's what's coming because we've seen our grandmothers and perhaps our mothers go through exactly that. But for decades, if we're here in our midlife, we've heard that weight is a beauty issue. It, you know, it's about magazines and diets and group chats. It's never really been discussed as a medical issue. And I think that's why it's so important to reframe it now, because it's cost women years, hasn't it? It's cost women decades. We should be living healthily and happily to at least 100, not 86.
And it's all to do with that aspirational marketing that is embedded so heavily in the beauty industry and the fashion industry. Impossible ideas about beauty actually sell product. And the framing of our body shape, reframing our body shape in terms of health rather than beauty, I think is fundamental. One of the things that I often see in the clinic is the pushback against the notions of beauty. I'm at an age where I'm comfortable in my skin, so I'm not worried about clothes and I'm not worried about how I look. I think we should be worried about our waistline. And if there's a creep there, we should be doing all that we can to be preventative rather than sort of balking against notions, societal notions of what beautiful is. We should reject all those models of this is beauty, especially what we see on social media. But what we should be doing is simply looking at our waistline, because if you want to do one thing that identifies you for future health risk, there's no blood test. Measure your waistline and look at your family history, because that is our future and our destiny. And we actually have got so much available to us that can change that.
So a waistline versus a weight number, very, very different things. Why is the waistline a better vital sign rather than your BMI, your body mass? Yes.
So it's all to do with the waistline being an index of our visceral adiposity, which is basically that fat that is in around our organs. It's in the abdominal cavity. Interestingly, it can also be the fat between your arm and your hip. So yes, the waistline fits in there, but so does, you know, the upper arm fat. So for quite a few women, as their waist starts to thicken, so does the fat around the upper arm. And that is, you know, if you like, a default fat store for when we're having too much energy in our diet and we're starting to see the weight creep. So when we come to thinking about waist versus BMI, the BMI is just weight divided by height squared. And it doesn't consider the body fat distribution. And this is where we come back to the simple notion of apples and pears. Are you an apple in shape, meaning that you carry the central fat, or are you a pear shape, meaning that it's the scientific term is gluteofemoral fat, so fat around the bottom and the hips. Now, that fat is really important for the sustenance of the next generation of human beings. So we tend to hold onto that fat until we have low estrogen, which is generally when we're breastfeeding. So if there should be a famine or a war or, you know, some dire event and we just have an infant to feed, that infant's nutrition is guaranteed because we have that fat around our bottom. And so that mobilizes when we're in low estrogen states, which is lactation, but it's also the menopause. So after the menopause with that low estrogen, fat tends to be redistributed to the central area. So if we are putting on weight after the menopause, it's going to be between our shoulder tip and our hips, and it's going to be that apple shape. And we know that that fat is a high turnover fat, so it circulates in our bloodstream to promote inflammation, to promote insulin resistance, to promote deposition in places where we don't want it, like in our coronary arteries and in our cerebral arteries that go to our brain. So that's when you start to see the increased risk of stroke and increased risk of coronary artery disease, heart disease. For women, the risk of heart disease and myocardial infarction or heart attack actually starts after the menopause. Women are protected up until that point. And it's completely related to the thickening of our waistline.
So when you see women in clinic, I'm sure there are common misunderstandings about weight, waist, and health risk. What sort of women come to you, and what point in their journey are they up to?
People come at all parts of the journey. So one of the things that delights me at the moment is that women are waking up to, my waist is thickening up, I'm perimenopausal, postmenopausal, I know this is detrimental, what can we do about it? I love it when you can get in early because, boy, it is prevention squared. You know, this is my life dream, is to see the prevention of diseases. I also see people when they are, morbidly overweight or obese. I see people when they've developed diabetes, sleep apnea, fatty liver disease, which is really common and already in America is the commonest cause of cirrhosis. It's no longer alcoholism or excess alcohol consumption. Increasingly oncologists, so cancer specialists, knowing that obesity or central obesity will impact the outcome or the effectiveness of chemotherapy or cancer therapy, are sending women for weight reduction, particularly with breast cancer, the best data for breast and prostate cancer. So I'm seeing more and more referrals for people from oncologists for patients with breast and prostate cancer saying, look, we know it's going to make a difference. Let's, you know, see if we can't improve that as well. And I think that's good holistic care. We know it makes such an impact in heart failure and heart disease. So cardiologists for a long time have been referring to me in order to help people with weight reduction. And we're far more capable in the last 10 years to be a bit more effective because we actually have medications that help. And I'm sure we're going to talk about that a bit later.
We all know, I guess, the 120 over 80 rule for blood pressure. What are the simple numbers that women can track for body fat risk, especially when it comes to waist circumference? And you're saying it doesn't matter what body shape you are or were, that there is a number for your waist and it counts.
Shelley, that's absolutely right. It's 80 centimetres. So it's so easy. A woman who has a waist circumference more than 80 centimetres has visceral obesity or central obesity. And I often get called up, patients will call me up and say, you've said that I'm centrally obese. I'm not obese. By body mass index, they might not be obese. By central measures, yes, they're certainly obese if they're centrally obese, if they have a waist that's maybe even 82 or 83 centimetres. And I think that that's, you know, really quite important. It doesn't have to be 100 centimetres or 90 centimetres like it is in men, just over 80 centimetres. It's so simple. And it's such a cheap test. All you need is a tape measure. But where do you measure your waistline? Because a lot of people have questions about that. It's usually the narrowest spot between the top of your ribs, sorry, the bottom of your ribs and the top of your hips. So you basically find the narrowest spot there and you throw the tape measure around and that's your waistline. It's not where your belly button is.
We have talked about this before and I still find it remarkable that no matter how tall you are, your ethnicity, where you carry your weight, your fitness levels, that all women have the same number?
Yes, it is. People have tried to drill down and see whether Asian women should have a higher number or a lower number. And they've got different ones for Asian men that is actually slightly lower. But for women, it's 80 centimetres, and you're absolutely right. I mean, if I see a woman who's 6'4", and there are some women who are 6'4", I will allow her to have a slightly bigger waist just because she's bigger all over. But, you know, for petite women, currently the waist is 80 centimetres, and I do actually wonder whether it should be even a bit lower in those very petite women. And I mean, you know, women who are probably under, you know, 1.5 or even under 1.55 meters tall.
I think if you've always battled with your weight or you've been diagnosed with diabetes, etc., it's probably a very, very different conversation that you have with your patients. For women who are thinking, my body has changed overnight, I'm carrying weight where I never used to, yes, my weight hasn't changed, but my belly is now larger than it ever was. This is more of, I guess, the issue that I'd like to discuss today, because hopefully those other people are receiving medical care and advice. But it's just this midlife slump, hump, growth, change, whatever it may be, that isn't related to food, and it's not necessarily related to the way we exercise. It's a metabolic change. Can you explain that for us all to make us feel like we're not out of control, that we can regain some power here?
So, Shelley, I want to reframe something of what you said, and I agree with everything you've said, but I think if you sort of reframe it a bit, it changes the perspective a bit. That midlife period is, you know, 20 years of working towards our prime years. So I see our prime years as being 70 plus. And so this,
even more now.
This kind of midlife period of, you know, the late 40s, mid 60s, where, you know, people from their headspace think, oh, it's all downhill from here. No. I don't agree with that. But definitely things are changing. And it's because of changes in our reproductive hormones. There are certainly environmental factors, which I know we will unpack a bit later, but it is all to do with hormonal factors, and it's to do with changes in our estrogen. So, you know, just as adolescence can be a tumultuous time in terms of hormonal changes, so can what we now call the perimenopause. And I see the perimenopause as 10 years, sometimes longer, before the menopause. The menopause simply is this line in the sand that says you haven't had a period for 12 months. But there can be hormonal changes in, for some women, even a bit more than a decade, coming up to the final 12 months with no periods. And some women will know this because they're starting to experience some hot flashes or skin changes or changes in libido, drive, mood that is coming up, you know, in one's 40s and early 50s. And this tells us, yes, the hormone levels are changing. Some women, another good marker is that the menstrual flow, the amount of volume that we lose each month, starts to change. So it might be a lot lighter and a lot shorter. And that just says there's a lot less estrogen. So estrogen stimulates fat oxidation. So this was part of my PhD a quarter of a century ago. We know that estrogen stimulates the oxidation of fat, the efficiency, if you like, of being able to burn fat. And one of the studies that I did for my PhD 25 years ago was look at what happens to postmenopausal women metabolically when you give them hormone replacement therapy. And we showed that there was an increase in metabolic rate of about 140 calories per day. So that's, you know, half of breakfast or the whole of breakfast, depending on what one has in the morning. And all of that energy expenditure was in fat oxidation. So we are, as our estrogen levels drift downwards, what we see is that our energy expenditure reduces, as well as our ability to burn fat effectively, and that it is partly reversible with hormone supplementation. Another thing, I mean, we showed major metabolic declines, and one of my fellow endocrinologists, Susan Davis, possibly 25 years ago also, showed that hormone replacement therapy reduces cholesterol as much as low-dose statin therapy. And that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. So we know that there are these metabolic changes that are to do with losing estrogen, and that they're at least partly reversible by just bringing the estrogen levels back up. Now, with menopause, that's not reversible. You can supplement hormones postmenopausally. But for hormone replacement therapy is a whole conversation in itself, and that's very personal, and women have different perspectives on that as well. So the hormones are a major factor impacting the thickening up of the waist. One of the other things that we showed in that study that I referred to, and I've already talked about, when we lose estrogen, we shift fat. If we're in energy, we're not in energy deficit, we're in energy excess, we'll deposit it around the middle. What we showed even after 6 months is that you shift fat away from the central depot on estrogen, so that you diminish, we reduced central fat with estrogen supplementation after the menopause. So, and that partly explains why there are those improvements in blood fat levels. I haven't mentioned we improved insulin resistance, and we also improved blood glucose levels just by simply shifting, well, it was related to how much fat you shifted away from the central depot. And these were weight stable women, which was really quite lovely. So there are all these metabolic things that change with estrogen. There are environmental things that are shifting as well, which is why, you know, this generation of women are experiencing those changes. And I know you've got that on the agenda for us to speak about, so I won't touch on it now.
No, I know you say that HRT or hormone replacement therapy is a different conversation, and look, it's absolutely a big one. But when you say it simply that the loss of estrogen is making us put on weight around the middle, if you were to take an estrogen supplement or use replacement therapy, is that guaranteed to shift the weight, and how much? I mean, I know that if you're just using the creams, it could be, or the gel, it could be very tempting to just layer this on if you think that it's going to help.
So we showed it was about 150 to 200 grams of central fat, which is actually quite considerable. In terms of, but is it going to be enough all on its own? If there is nothing in our lifestyle that also needs fine-tuning, and look, I mean, we live in difficult environmental circumstances at the moment that throw up challenges, so that there's been sort of paradigm shifts over the last even 10 years, whether it's you know, use of our devices. I'm shocked at how much time I spend on devices, my IT, whether it's the phone or the computer. And I know that it would be a lot more than 10 years ago, even though my exercise and my diet hasn't shifted in that period. So there are other subtle things that constantly we need to bring our attention to, so we can just kind of diminish them. So putting on, it's not going to be a single shot panacea HRT. It requires the whole, because if one has gained central fat, one probably should be deep diving into other aspects of our lifestyle that might need some fine tuning.
Well, let's have a look at that, because you say if your exercise has continued but you are spending more time on your device, are we talking here about our cortisol levels or stress that's creating?
But let's just talk about devices for a second, and talk about blue light. And a lot of us would be using devices at night. And the blue light that we are exposed to actually interferes with sleep quality and sleep duration. So, and we know that that changes the metabolism and promotes that slight shift in circadian rhythms, and the diminution or reduction in sleep duration, the reduction in REM sleep, the reduced dreaming. All of that can kind of upset the cortisol levels. Certainly the shift, sleep deprivation increases cortisol levels. That single element alone would be shifting our metabolism. And one of the things that I often do with people is say, look, you know, let's measure your time spent on devices. Let's also measure your sleep. So one of the research studies that I'm doing at the moment, Mind Your Heart, is actually looking at sleep quality, metabolism, and brain health and brain aging. So we're very much interested in how sleep, because we know sleep reduction shifts circadian rhythms. It shifts our metabolism. It increases the cortisol. And I say to people, wake up when the sun is up and get sunlight on the retina, because years ago somebody showed that when you get sunlight on the retina, there's these fascinating responses between our retina, our ocular nerves, going down through the parasympathetic nervous system to our liver to open up and switch on the liver's ability to burn fat. So that's just sunlight on the retina in the morning. And so people that sleep in, people that don't get up till 9-10 o'clock in the morning, shift workers, all of this sort of thing, these are part of the challenges with, even if the diet is fine and one's doing some exercises, these are some of the things that at a basal level change our metabolism in an adverse way.
I'm doing all the things, so why is my waistline still growing? Yes, we hear this all the time, and it's why we created the 120 Club. It's for women in perimenopause and menopause who are done trying to solve this on their own. If you want to understand what's really happening in your body, know what to focus on, and follow a simple, supported path forward, you've found your place and you've found your people. Inside the 120 Club, we teach the Aging Project method, a better option than diets, scales, and those quick fixes. Our big dream? To help women shift their waistlines and live healthier, stronger, longer lives. Ready to learn more? Visit theagingproject.com and download our free scorecard to get started.
It's quite extraordinary, isn't it? Because on their own,
you don't put the puzzle together. You don't say, well, I do sleep in, or I don't get that early morning light, and I know that my circadian rhythm is a little bit out because I was on the phone every night, or I'm binging a series or whatever it might be, which would make you feel good in one part because you're getting that dopamine rush. But those roll-on effects, but that's something that you can change. And I love the fact that every morning we have this opportunity to start well. So even if you have had bad sleep or interrupted sleep patterns for weeks, tomorrow is a wonderful opportunity to start afresh. And when you explain it so simply, that small action in the morning can really have an effect, not just all day, but this metabolic change in your body will start to occur.
That's right. That's right. I mean, there's so much we can be doing. And part of it is, I mean, I love this part because, you know, I grow vegetables and I'm really into nature. But it's getting in touch with planetary movements, the day, the extent, the day, the seasonality in our food supply, all of these fabulous things that are really going back to nature. You know, we should be sleeping when it's night. Okay, we might sleep a bit longer during the winter. That's great because that's catch up for the summer. We should be eating seasonally. It's, you know, the nutrition is best when we're seasonal in our vegetable choices and food choices. And the modern world and the working 24 hours and the never switching off is so detrimental. And people probably notice this when they feel so good when they're on holidays.
Mm-hmm. But you never relate that to your waistline, do
no,
you?
No.
Think, oh, I'm feeling better because I'm not doing anything, or I'm not doing as much, or I'm taking time for me, all that self-care. But in this conversation, it's, you know, it's wonderful. Maybe that is the driver that you need to treat yourself better.
Yes.
Because we are all, you know, vain in some way, shape or form. We all want to feel better and look better, but unless you correlate the two, you might not take those opportunities. If you know it's going to make you drop a few around the waist, getting up early doesn't seem quite so tedious or quite so tricky.
No.
So in plain English, the biggest drivers would be, obviously we know food and intake is a huge one. Sleep, you've mentioned, is imperative. It must happen. Our hormones, that's something that we can help control, but are changing, absolutely. Movement, we know, is a big one. And ultra-processed foods, you know, just in our way of life that we live now, is huge. I want to narrow down on stress, because I know that is a big one for me when I'm under the pump and not necessarily in a stressful situation, but I know that there are lots of things going on and lots of balls in the air. This does change how I feel around my tummy because I'm now aware of that.
Yes. So there are two hormones that really promote central fat deposition. We've already talked that estrogen diverts it away to the bottom area, but it's cortisol, and the other big one is insulin. So both of those promote central obesity. And you're absolutely right. A stressful situation can be a positive stress. It can just be working on a project that's really, really positive and we're really excited about, but it is stressful. Any of those influences can raise the cortisol level in a chronic way. And sometimes, you know, women are dealing, we'll speak specifically about women. Women are dealing with, yes, hormonal changes, but they're also dealing often with adolescence and behavior management, and there are constant battles that are ongoing at a very cerebral level, as one tangoes with one's teenagers, and so these are common things. And then you bring in work stress and deadlines, and you bring in traffic, and you bring in increasingly parental health and being the sandwich generation and looking after parents that are failing and need a lot of support, and then on the other hand, small children and adolescents, and then on top of that, being the domestic goddess, and then also being at work.
The layers.
So there's so many things that can trigger our cortisol, and it is like the frog in the boiling water, that the temperature raises so very gradually that you don't actually know you're at breaking point until, you know, the straw that breaks the camel's back comes along. So we have so many different chronic levels of stress that can be positive, negative, that we just don't even recognize. And it is where it's so important to be, making sure that the brain gets to switch off, making sure that we're taking some deep breaths, making sure that we're responding to the day's activities, not in a reactive way, I mean, we often have to be, but in a planned forward way, which requires a bit of organization and planning. What's happening this week? What have I got to do? When am I going to have a break? When have I got 5 minutes to just take some deep breaths or even do a slightly guided meditation? Yoga, I think of as being fabulous because quite a lot of the postures in yoga actually stimulate the parasympathetic nervous system, which helps slow down the stress adrenergic stress system. So there are physical postures as well as breathing exercises, and you don't have to do pranayama in yoga to just do some quiet breathing that'll just help bring down that stress. And so especially for women who are increasingly working from home and Zooming, plan that your meetings, you've got to give yourself 5 minutes between meetings so that you can do some deep breathing. Don't be jumping from one Zoom room to the next. Sign off. I've got another meeting to go to. Sign off at 5 to 10 minutes before the Zoom meeting actually ends. And if you have the capacity or the ability to chair a meeting and keep it rolling in a very planned way, don't just let things flow, but have that 5 minutes to break, catch your breath, plan what's going to happen in the next Zoom meeting, and then hop into the next one. All of these little things are helpful. You know, with adolescents and children, always remember, give them choice, but give them the two choices that suit you perfectly. So, and if you need some support with that, psychologists are wonderful in helping negotiate that adolescent growth period where, especially with adolescent girls, they love you greatly, dearly, but they just need to develop their little horns. And who are they going to butt up against? The person who will always love them, so that's their mother. So it is about getting through those challenging times with the people that we love the most, who are probably going to promote the greatest cortisol rise, and that's our children and our parents. And it's how do you manage that when we have so much on our plate? So I think be proactive in that regard as well, to just help bring those cortisol levels down.
And that's enough to make a difference, Catherine. If you take those 5 minute pauses throughout the day, wherever you can grab a moment to take a moment for yourself, have a few deep breaths, that can really make a difference to the fat that we carry around our waist.
We know that those biofeedback mechanisms reduce blood pressure too. So it is about that self-care. It is about, our hormonal regulation. And the cortisol side, we can partly control. Things happen and we'll be triggered to be very stressed. So blood pressure will rise, cortisol will rise. But we can help mitigate that with, what has been traditionally called biofeedback. I'm feeling really stressed. Let's take some deep breaths. And that will help bring all that down.
I love the fact that 70 is now my prime, so I'm looking very much forward to that. We talked about cortisol and obviously stress, but like the frog in the boiling water, it seems that insulin resistance is something that has also built up over time, perhaps with those stress levels and not having those moments of breath work and bringing our cortisol level down. We've also sort of built up this resistance, this insulin resistance at the same time. We get to midlife and it's like, wow, this is now something else that I have to think about.
So again, reproductive hormones, estrogen drops increase insulin resistance. Gaining a little bit of fat around our waistline will promote insulin resistance. It's not just resistance, it's actually our response to foods as well, because when we eat carbohydrate, we'll get an insulin spike. So you can actually be relatively trim and have a normal waist circumference, but have high insulin levels because you elect to eat a diet that is high in carbohydrates. And these are not just fairy floss and sugar and all the common things that people think about, but it can also be high quality carbohydrates. What have previously been sort of talked about, though we don't talk about them so much anymore, low GI foods. So even things like breads that can be wholemeal or sweet potato, so really very healthy carbohydrates. If you're eating those constantly or grazing on fruit, another healthy carbohydrate, but it can cause a high insulin, some of the fruits can actually produce quite a high insulin spike. And so if you're hyperinsulinemic all through the day, even though you baseline, you're not insulin resistant, that can promote central fat as well. So insulin resistance, absolutely, but high insulin promoted by a high carbohydrate diet, that will promote weight gain as well. And I mean, most women who've had children would have some idea about this, because why do we give lemonade and, you know, these electrolyte drinks that are full of sugar to kids with diarrhea? It's because it defends their body fat stores. So you prevent weight loss by having a constant or regular infusion of carbohydrate, be it simple sugars like sugar or fructose or lactose, or be it complex carbohydrates such as oats, cereals, breads, and of course fruit. So if you're having carbohydrates spread throughout the day, then that might also be and be hyperinsulinemic or have elevated insulin levels, then that is also going to promote central fat gain, especially in that vulnerable period as hormone levels, estrogen levels start coming down. So it is important when we think about our diet, and especially, I mean, you've already mentioned ultra-processed foods. One of the challenges we have on our food labelling at the moment, and this would be one of the things I would like to see change in time, is that the food manufacturers list carbohydrates separately to sugars. It should all be in the same thing, so that people are seeing that they're getting simple and complex carbohydrates together to help identify those foods. Ultra-processed foods, what are they? So they're foods where you take whole food and you break it down into its components, and then you add those components to reconstitute food. And a lot of us have already understood reconstituted orange juice, for example, and how that's perhaps not the ideal way that we should be having our vitamin C each morning. But a lot of foods these days contain, when you look at it, cornstarch, for example, that is an ultra-processed food. It's high fructose, and being a fructose type of sugar, it stimulates one of the highest insulin spikes. And years ago at one of the first international obesity conferences I went to, I sat next to, I didn't know who he was, George Bray, who is the godfather, the grandfather and the godfather of obesity research. He writes textbooks. He's retired now, but he writes textbooks. And he said to me as an aside, he's from Baton Rouge. So he has that kind of American drawl. The American obesity epidemic started when we introduced cornstarch to our foods. And I think he's right. You know, for years I've been thinking he's right. I was later embarrassed I didn't strike up much more of a conversation with him, because he is the key figure in obesity management that has been for maybe 50 years. And so, you know, cornstarch, that's easy to look for, but it is in so much of our foods, including healthy things like our wholemeal breads. And it shouldn't be there. It is an ultra-processed food that gives us that insulin spike. The other thing, why is cornstarch in a lot of our foods? My own theory is when you get an insulin spike, you get hungrier and you consume more. So that's possibly why so many breads actually are sweet these days. Burger buns are sweet. Even some of our plain yogurts, so-called, have got all-natural fruit juice added to them. Again, it increases that insulin spike, and we're hungrier and we consume more and more. So you start with what you think is a healthy snack, and you just keep going.
It's also bringing back that full cycle and saying preparing my own food or preparing a meal. Yes, you could see it as a chore, and I know in the afternoons when the whole family's there and everybody's starving and you've rushed in from afternoon activities, it does make for a stressful situation. But if you can reverse that in your mind and say, okay, I'm going to prepare a meal for my family, I'm going to take this time to deep breathe and to bring my cortisol levels down and find the joy in preparing good food that I know is not only nourishing my body but also reducing my waistline, funnily enough, at the same time. I think if we start to piece all this together and find those micro moments and then relate them back to something that we actually care about, whether that be our physical appearance, if that's the first layer, or our overall health, I think it's just finding those moments in whatever you're doing to bring your levels down, your cortisol levels down, but to also give yourself a moment and know you're doing good for your body. It all goes around, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And one of the things you said there, which was really important, is the family. Because what we do for our food prep, and look, it does not have to be chef. You know, I'm really against us having chef-type meals every night. There are the weekdays, there are the weeknight, there are the weekend days. But during the week, it just needs to be protein, veg, and a little bit of carbohydrate. And the idea that you're chopping up 7 different coloured vegetables, that's just a rod for the back. Quick meals. But what you're doing by that is also showing your children and teaching your children that food prep matters, what healthy meals look like, and what they're going to do in their adulthood in the future. So we know that people who have not been exposed to, you know, their parents cooking are much more reliant on takeaway food. So, you know, and this really matters for our future generations and their health. So those very simple, and I say to people, scrambled eggs on toast is a perfectly nutritious meal if you don't have time. Mm-hmm. It can be on the table in 3 minutes. So it's part of that whole thing of the end of the day, winding down, and involve the whole family in cooking and cleaning up. You know, the domestic goddess is not the servant. Yeah.
Let's talk about, again, why this wider waistline has so many health effects, the roll-on effects, whether that be joint pain or back pain, or of course, your decline in mobility. It's all related.
Correct. So we can break it down into mechanical and metabolic. And so the mechanical are definitely the lower back pain, the hip pain, the knee pain. And some of us have had sports injuries or skiing injuries or have had pregnancies where our back starts to, and back and hips sort of go out. So, yes, there is the mechanical effect, but it's also inflammatory. Inflammation promotes joint pain. The metabolic effects erode every aspect of our health. And it is partly to do with the pro-inflammatory effects of central obesity and insulin resistance. So that inflammation, if you think of it as bleach on almost everything, degrading, destroying, promoting coronary artery disease, promoting arterial disease, coronaries, the cerebral vessels to our brain, so future stroke risk. We know it has a huge impact on that. We know it promotes diabetes. We know it promotes fatty liver disease and cirrhosis. The big thing that people don't appreciate is that visceral obesity predicts cancer. And so early onset excess weight promotes early onset cancer, by which I mean cancer in ones before 50. And the obesity epidemic is now linked to early onset cancer. Being centrally overweight is a major predictive factor for breast and prostate cancer, colonic cancer, esophageal cancer, endometrial cancer. Women who are overweight, insulin resistant, centrally obese, who have irregular menstrual cycles, are at higher risk of uterine cancer for life. So there are all of these other negatives, and it's all to do with insulin resistance and high insulin, at a minimum, but the cancers are the big things, because we have great therapies to lower heart risk, lower stroke risk. A big thing we can do to reduce future cancer risk is look at our waistlines and manage them.
And now we're being afforded the opportunity to have a helping hand at that. And I'm going to talk GLP-1 medications. And I know that there is an absolute need for them in a lot of cases. For those that are thinking this is just going to help me get back on track, I'd love to hear your clinical perspective on that.
So what works in the long term is chronic behaviour change around food and maintaining a degree of energy restriction below what we used to have that got us up to the weight and the waist that we are, and maintaining that for the long term, because I see no point in people yo-yoing, because we know that that weight cycling is bad for us and people end up going higher. So using any intervention, whether it's a very low energy diet, a 3-day fast, some of the other drugs that are available, and the GLP-1 receptor agonists, using them just to kickstart things along, but make no commitment to chronic lifestyle change, a new normal way of eating, that's not going to work in the long run. So unless people are really ready to make chronic behavior change, then these medications, bariatric surgery, fast diets, nothing's going to work in the long run.
They kind of make you feel more in control, though, or confident, or that it was just that last little bit and now I'll maintain a healthy lifestyle.
But you have to make the changes right from the beginning. The behavioural, the neurocognitive research shows us that if water, think about it in this way, if water falls on the mountain, which way will it go down? It will take the most well-worn pathway, which is the behaviour that we have always been doing, sometimes for, you know, 40 or 50 years. If you want to stop that behaviour and start a new one, you have to repeat, 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 repeat. You block off the usual pathway and you start creating a new little creek bed down the mountain, and you have to reinforce that behaviour change, reinforce that behaviour change, reinforce that behaviour change. And it takes, the neurocognitive research shows, 3 years of repeating, repeat, repeat, repeat. So this is a long-term journey. It's not just, I just need to get rid of the food noise for a few months and get things in place and then I'll be okay. No, you need to change the behaviour for 3 years. And I think that that's important. One of the things that people regularly talk about is food noise. And they'll talk about, it's just gotten rid of the food noise. In part, that's because they've calorie restricted and they've reduced their carbohydrates, because what they've done is they've suppressed their insulin levels. So what I talked about earlier about, you know, promoting cravings and ongoing food-seeking behaviour, that's part of it. So carbohydrate restriction will often help one achieve an element of that. And then there are the people who are wired to be overweight and obese and have constant intrusive food thoughts. And for some of them, the GLP-1 receptor agonists are really very, very helpful. And it evens up the playing ground for them so that they can start to make behaviour change. They can start eliminating some of the food triggers that they've had, the environmental triggers. Shelley, a little bit more hormone. I haven't talked about ghrelin, but when we see food, we trigger ghrelin, which is a hormone that promotes appetite. It increases gastric emptying in order to make room in our stomach for the food that is definitely coming. And so we seek food. And this is a real issue with food advertising, food product placement, all of these sorts of things that are in our daily environment. So there are the, even when we're leading low carb eating, where, you know, we've emptied the pantry looks like a famine pantry. We've diminished all of the usual walking places where we go to, where we see something, we think, oh, I might have some of that. And then a bus drives by with a food advertisement and you think, oh, that would be interesting, wouldn't it? So it really is hard to manage our environment, given some things are in our control and a lot of things are not in our control. But ghrelin is yet another hormone that, you know, is constantly being triggered by the environment that we live in. And a lot of these things can overwhelm even the effect of the GLP-1s. So they are definitely a game changer and a very important part of our therapeutic armamentarium, which is multi-pronged. And for some people, who struggle with obesity, you know, we may be looking at lifelong therapy with them unless better things come up. In the same way, we would look at intestinal rearrangement with something as massive as a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, which is one of the bariatric surgical procedures that people have been having, you know, for the last 20 years or more. So, you know, people talk about, but we don't have long-term side effect data. That's absolutely true. We have 7-year, 8-year with semaglutide, which is one of the more commonly used GLP-1 receptor agonists. But the GLP-1s have been around for 23, 24 years. The first one was exenatide, and that was, you know, a very effective medication that promoted the research that, in terms of weight reduction, that promoted the research that then led to drugs like tirzepatide, which is Mounjaro, and Ozempic and Wegovy, and tirzepatide, which is Mounjaro, in being developed, because it was exenatide or Byetta was around for a long, long, long time before these drugs became available. And their long-term safety data looks good. But, of course, we need more.
Mm. And we're just suggesting that anyone who is thinking of that does it with proper practitioner support.
Absolutely.
You say some mental support as well, because there's a lot of challenges that aren't just about suppressing the actual appetite.
Exactly. GLP-1 receptor therapy requires a clinician who is going to support on diet, exercise prescription. Physical activity is so important. If you're not exercising and doing strength training, you're going to lose a lot of muscle that you may never get back on GLP-1s. So it's very important that exercise prescription is also happening. There needs to be psychological support. There needs to be drilling down into all of the factors that trigger the sort of the detrimental eating behaviors that one wants to be avoiding, because they're important. One, often people eat for so many different reasons. There may be depressed mood and other factors, that anxiety, that need to be addressed appropriately as well, because otherwise it's a band-aid and it's not going to help that one individual keep their weight and their waist healthier for the long term, which is what we should be aiming for.
I think what you're doing for us today, Catherine, is giving us that motivation and that little kick up the butt that perhaps we all need. But then we get to this point and we go, okay, I'm ready, but what do I do first? Where do I start? What can I do this week that is going to make positive change?
Yeah. So the first thing is know where you sit. If your weight's increased, then go back to, you know, your healthy weight or the weight that you used to be. And I'm not talking about when you were 18. I'm talking about in your one's 30s. Get a tape measure and throw it around your waist. And if it's over, you know, 80 centimetres, usually 1 centimetre above, you need 1 kilo off. 2 centimetres, 82 centimetres, you might need 2 kilos off. If you are perimenopausal and struggling, please go and talk to your doctor about what role hormone replacement, menopause hormone therapy may have in your life. And this is a risk assessment and a very, very personal discussion. If we're training for marathons or half marathons, then obviously we need more. If we're pregnant, we definitely need more. We need to look at, you know, are we a candidate for intermittent fasting? And, you know, there's backwards and forwards, and there was a meta-analysis and a systematic review recently that suggested that intermittent fasting, you know, is not so helpful. I think you have to look at the individual studies and how well they were conducted. When, you know, science often, some areas of science, like meta-analysis, can, by lumping together studies of high quality and studies of low quality, do not do scientific inquiry any benefit. So I tend to put very little weight on meta-analyses, and I'm the chief editor for a scientific journal that's based in Switzerland on obesity, and if I see a meta-analysis, I'll have a quick look, and it gets a rejection because they're very low quality often. Just because you have lots of numbers does not mean that the quality of them merits any examination at all. So I think there still is a place in intermittent fasting if this fits in with your lifestyle. And look, if
and you look at any age, Catherine, because we've sort of been on the idea of that once you are in perimenopause or menopause, that's not an option for you. But you're saying if that's what makes you feel good, and perhaps it's really just making your eating window smaller, that is still safe and fine for women in perimenopause and menopause?
It's to be encouraged. I mean, if you move to the south of France, Greece, Italy, and yes, follow their traditional eating patterns, you would automatically be doing an intermittent fast. Mm-hmm. Breakfast as a notion came about with the Industrial Revolution, when people were working 12 to 14 hours in places remote from home. And breakfast cereals only developed after World War II. So these are not things that fit into the bigger picture of human history. And some of them have a lot to do with food marketing. So I'm not convinced that you have to have breakfast. I think for school children, they need a good meal to head off for the day, because then you have no way of supervising that they eat what's in their lunchbox, the glorious lunch that you prepared for them. But for adults who can be assured of a good, healthy lunch meal that starts with some protein, and then a little bit of carb, and then green veg, especially if you're putting on weight, then that's a perfect option if it fits for you. And I think it's really important that we think about individualizing diet. There is no one size fits all. So it has to be individual. It has to fit with your food preferences, your eating styles, all of those things. But there's nothing invalid about intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating.
Good to hear. We know the measurement is important, and we are obviously asking our GPs for as much support as possible. And as you say, having that conversation about perhaps some hormone replacement there. What other markers are important for you? Is it blood pressure? Is it bloods? What tests would you ask for?
Okay. So I would look at blood glucose levels, blood pressure, blood fat levels, and the pattern there is not total cholesterol. It's having high triglycerides. It's high triglycerides and the low protective cholesterol, the HDL cholesterol. If the HDL, the protective cholesterol, is low and the triglycerides are high, this is a diabetes, cancer, and heart disease risk. It's not the total cholesterol as it is for men. So it's quite different between men and women. It's worth having liver function done. And if they're up, especially if what's called the GGT is up, it means you're drinking too much. You know, alcohol is another elephant in the room. I'll have a Chardonnay at lunch, maybe once a week. Maybe you just have 2 to 3 glasses of wine as a woman, max, rather than half a bottle with girlfriends for that long lunch that might happen regularly. Alcohol is absolutely so. If your GGT is up, it means it's harming your body. Look out for that. Mm-hmm.
If you're a prime minister for the day, and I'd give you a lot longer than that, obviously, Catherine, what are the 3 policy moves that you'd make to shift this trajectory that we have now of just overweight, concentrating on things that can actually make a huge change?
The first thing I would do is I would honour the United Nations Charter on the Rights of the Child. And this is 20 years old. And I would get rid of food advertising to children. So that would be the first thing. And it's in the Charter on the Rights of the Child. That's number one. And we've known about this for an awfully long time. The second thing that I would do is make every entity that receives taxpayer-funded money, like public transport, have a zero advertising from the food industry. Because food advertising today has the same impact as smoking advertising did, and the government outruled that. So across everything, you can't control the corporate world, but you could control the world that you fund, which would be a lot of our environment, which provides some of those visual food triggers for people. They can make their money advertising, I don't know, healthy things rather than fast food or high energy foods. The third thing that I would do, oh, this is so complex because there were so many things, would be every new community that is built in Australia has to have excellent public transport, rapid public transport, facilities and parks for playing, because we know women do not exercise if there are no parks or safe areas. And we know, I mean, there are so many people who might spend, you know, 3 to 4 hours per day trapped in their cars and sedentary. And that has to change. And we know it can be done. And we do it really well in some areas, and we don't do it quite so well. So it would be in urban planning. And as you've only given me three, I'm going to stop there, Shelley.
Well, as I said, I would keep you in office for a very, very long time. And those three things that you have mentioned are seemingly so easy to make changes to very, very quickly, which, again, will have an incredible roll-on effect to everyone, not just women in midlife, but for everyone, just thinking about food differently, thinking about beauty differently, thinking about how much we actually need to consume every day, and that can cross over so many other areas of our lives as well. The tips that you've given us today, again, we know them and we've heard them time and time again, but to hear them from you, I'm sure, is going to have a huge impact on people to take charge of their own health and to stop thinking of weight as a beauty issue, but really as a health issue and a huge problem in this country.
Thank you very much, Shelley. It's been an absolute pleasure to be part of your podcast today.
As always, the Ageing Project podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes. Always seek medical advice from a qualified practitioner.